Iran says it has no decision on direct talks with the US, but might consider such negotiations if they help reach a good deal with strong guarantees at the Vienna talks. Syria condemns US-led sanctions against the country, saying the bans amount to economic terrorism and target the Syrian people's right to life. Also in the headline, Saudi-led warplanes launch new airstrikes on the Yemeni capital and nearby cities as Riyadh escalates its aggression against the war-torn country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says developing ties with neighboring countries is the Islamic Republic's foreign policy priority. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment during the first national conference of Iran and neighbors in Tehran. Amir Abdullahian said his country welcomes new round of talks with Saudi Arabia, adding that Tehran has kept the door open for Riyadh. He noted that Iran would respond positively whenever Riyadh decides to normalize its diplomatic relations with Tehran. The top diplomat also called on Saudi Arabia and the UAE to take a constructive political approach to end the blockade and war on Yemen and pave the way for an intra-Yemeni dialogue. He also touched upon the ongoing Vienna negotiations on the revival of the 2015 deal and the possibility of direct talks with the U.S.
The American side sends us messages through various means where they express their desire to have a level of direct negotiations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Our direct negotiations are with the P4+1 currently. If we get to a stage where reaching a good deal with strong guarantees necessitates direct talks with the United States, we will consider this in the agenda that we will have in the negotiations to remove sanctions.
Amir Abdullahian, however, added that there's no decision yet on any direct talks with Washington. His comments come as the eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal is underway in the Austrian capital. The talks are also aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions that the U.S. imposed following its unilateral withdrawal from the deal in 2018. The U.S. is not directly involved in the talks. So the talks are aimed at removing anti-Iran sanctions the U.S. imposed following its unilateral withdrawal from the deal in 2018. Herman Lesky has more details on this.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the 2015 agreement that promised sanctions relief for certain caps on Iran's nuclear program are intensifying the process of drafting a revived deal. Delegates from Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU have now adopted a new format for discussions, meeting together in one room to focus on the Iranian demands for verified and effective removal of US sanctions and guarantees Washington will not withdraw from the agreement in future or reimpose sanctions. This while expert-level talks continue in other rooms on Iranian nuclear commitments and the sequencing of steps that need to be taken for Iran and the US to go back to full compliance. European and American officials have been raising concerns about the amount of time left to reach a conclusion, with some diplomats suggesting they only have weeks, and other sources citing early February as an unofficial deadline.
If Western countries give the necessary assurances, these necessary guarantees, and if they remove the sanctions, then that will be enough. But if they want to drag their feet, if they want to be slow about it, then the negotiations will be slow. For Iran, that is the issue. Dates, the length of the negotiations, whether it takes a week or a month or a year, that's irrelevant. Because the Iranians know if they get a bad deal, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do about it. So they have to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans are unable to cheat them at the negotiating table.
Sources close to the talks say the negotiations are progressing at a normal pace. To claim that the talks have stagnated is unfair, they say, because resolving the outstanding issues requires further discussions given the complexities of the problems. Homolesky, Vienna.
Elsewhere, Damascus slams US-led sanctions against Syria as economic terrorism, saying the bans have had catastrophic impacts on the country's human rights situation. Deputy Foreign Minister Bashar Jaafari says the coercive economic measures target people's livelihood and their right to life and welfare. He was addressing the UN Human Rights Council's first review of Syria's record since October 2016. Jaafari accused Britain, France, Israel, Turkey, and the US of violating international law by occupying parts of his country. He said the foreign occupation in support of terrorist groups has limited Syria's ability to protect its citizens' human rights. He also accused the US forces of destroying oil and gas infrastructures in the Euphrates region. Jaafari stressed that the Syrian government is facilitating aid deliveries while facing what he called a systematic terrorist war. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched fresh airstrikes on Yemen, causing more damage to the impoverished country. The Saudi-led coalition's fighter jets repeatedly pounded different areas in the capital Sana'a and its neighboring cities. There is still no report of possible casualties. The provinces of Hajjah and Sa'da were also targeted earlier on Monday. The coalition has stepped up its airstrikes on Yemen over the past week, leaving more than 100 people killed and many more injured. The United Nations has condemned the deadly airstrikes and called for an immediate and transparent investigation into the raids. Activist and political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says the latest Saudi-led airstrikes will prompt more intensified retaliatory attacks from the Yemeni side, especially against the UAE.
Today, the Saudi coalition has conducted in the last hour about 12 airstrikes on the capital Sana'a. Two of these airstrikes have targeted a communication tower in Khawlan. This show you that the attack that was on the Yemen international gate for the internet, which has blocked the country for about 5 days, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates continue to target communication towers and communication center across Yemen. That's why I believe that this latest airstrike on Sana'a is a clear message from the United Arab Emirates that they are not willing to stop their attack and their strike against Yemen, and that I believe that Sana'a will take up its attacks, will step up its attacks against United Arab Emirates. As Al-Amid Yahya Sari' have said in the last 24 hours after the second attack against Saudi Arabia, that we will widen our airstrike to reach more sensitive side inside United Arab Emirates and as well inside Saudi Arabia.
South Korean arms manufacturers recently signed the country's largest ever single export deal with the United Arab Emirates for a missile defense system. But some South Korean activists worry about the deal's impact on the conflict in Yemen, as well as South Korea's efforts to attract support for peace on the Korean Peninsula. Frank Smith reports.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in returned from visits to the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt Saturday. In Dubai, South Korean companies inked the country's largest ever single-arm sale, a reported $3.5 billion missile defense system for the UAE. Some South Korean activists worry about the human cost.
South Korea's decision to export weapons rather than trying to help to peacefully resolve the conflict raises a voice of concern over the export because it generates further tension, conflict, and division in the region.
South Korea's also increased weapons exports to Saudi Arabia. Chung Uk-shik has tracked South Korea's weapons sales for 20 years.
The U.S. military industrial complex is always mentioned and criticized, but one can question whether South Korea will also gradually develop a military industrial complex through continued weapons exports.
South Korea has steadily increased its arms development over the past two decades and now ranks as the world's sixth leading weapons exporter. South Korean companies have also diversified their offerings to include tanks, missiles, and even controversial cluster bombs. Saudi Arabia has deployed South Korea's Raybolt anti-tank guided missile to Yemen, where the conflict features more advanced weapons. Riyadh's recent airstrikes generated mass demonstrations there, but little interest in South Korea. Activist Chung worries how arms exports will affect diplomacy.
The government, media, and the South Korean people need to reflect about on how our appeals for support for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be considered when South Korea is increasing weapons exports under the rationale of profit and income.
President Moon Jae-in's trip comes as his single term is set to wrap up in May. However, South Korea's arms industry enjoys broad bipartisan political support. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine has reached the fever pitch. The United States says it has put around 8,500 of its troops on standby for deployment to Eastern Europe. The Pentagon made the announcement saying the troops will be dispatched if Russia invades Ukraine. Washington says the forces are intended to bolster NATO's quick response force. The military alliance has announced that its member states are sending additional ships and fighter jets to Eastern Europe. NATO has vowed to take all necessary measures to reinforce its alliance in response to what it calls Russia's buildup of troops near Ukraine's border. The European Union has also pledged aid for Ukraine and threatened sanctions against Russia.
On Monday, ministers from the EU's 27 member states gathered in Brussels to discuss growing tensions with Russia. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken joined them via video link. The West warns the toughest ever financial sanctions against Moscow will be unveiled if Ukraine is invaded.
It will be a quick and determined action with a strong unity, not only within the European Union, but also internationally.
Moscow accuses the West of unnecessary provocation. This as the US ponders deploying thousands of troops and military hardware to Eastern Europe. Many security analysts say the Kremlin is fully justified in demanding that NATO halts its expansion around Russia. There's concern that if a new sanctions package is unveiled, Moscow could turn off the EU's essential gas supplies. Speaking to us online, the European Policy Centre's Amanda Paul expressed scepticism regarding threats from Brussels.
There may not be a strong desire from some member states to have very tough sanctions that could actually have economic losses for those member states themselves.
Also on Monday, the EU announced €1.2 billion to support Ukraine.
This package will help Ukraine now to address its financing needs due to the conflict. We count on the Council and the European Parliament to adopt this emergency macrofinancial assistance as soon as possible.
Von der Leyen says a further €6 billion is in the pipeline for Kiev. This is in addition to the €17 billion already sent by the EU to Ukraine since 2014. Critics are incensed because the bloc's own agency, the European Court of Auditors, says Ukraine is extremely corrupt. Negotiations between the West and Russia will continue at various political levels in the coming days. Analysts say the only option is for both sides to give ground, because the alternative is unthinkable. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Elsewhere, in what's been described as a partial victory, the British High Court of Justice has granted WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to appeal to the country's Supreme Court against his extradition to the US. This amid worries about his mental health, as he continues to be locked up at a maximum security prison in the UK. If extradited, he'll face up to 175 years in the US prison system. Saeed Poreza reports.
A moment of celebration for supporters of Julian Assange. Another chance at preventing his extradition to the United States on espionage charges. His partner, with whom he has two young children, shared the good news.
The High Court certified that we had raised point of law of general public importance, and that the Supreme Court has good grounds to hear this appeal. The situation now is that the Supreme Court has to decide whether it will hear the appeal. But make no mistake, we won today in court.
In December last year, judges in this court decided there was no ground to believe Assange was a clear suicide risk, which an earlier ruling had found to be the case. Also last year, U.S. government lawyers gave assurances Assange would not be treated inhumanely if extradited. assurances Assange's legal team and supporters find hard to believe.
The assurances are really misnamed. They aren't assurances and they aren't guarantees, because contained within the very same document is the provision that the United States can withdraw them at any time.
The U.S. wants Assange to face trial over the release in 2010 of thousands of classified military documents relating to U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. Rights groups have denounced his treatment and described it as a serious threat to press freedom.
It's an extremely worrying case, and it will have huge implications for journalism and press freedom internationally. If the U.S. is successful in extraditing Julian Assange and prosecuting him under the Espionage Act there, he would be the first publisher prosecuted under that law, which lacks a public interest defense. That same precedent could be applied to any publisher, any journalist, any source. So we would see likely a very serious chilling effect, in particular on national security reporting around the world, any type of journalism that deals with leaked information. So this is one reason we highlight this case is, of course, Julian Assange's own rights are at stake here, but what this means for journalism around the world is extremely alarming.
Today's decision, a partial victory for the campaign to release Julian Assange. It will now be up to the Supreme Court to decide if it will hear Assange's case. But until that happens, his supporters say the fight to win his freedom is on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The attempt to pass voting rights legislation died in the Senate recently, a huge blow to US President Joe Biden and his party, in a year which finishes with midterm elections in which Republicans are expected to prosper. We now present you an article written jointly by Martin Pengelly and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled Kyrsten Sinema, Arizona Democrat Censure Senator for Voting Rights Failure. The Arizona Democratic Party has formally censured Kyrsten Sinema, the U.S. senator whose opposition to filibuster reform helped sink attempts to protect voting rights. In a statement on Saturday, 22nd of January, the Arizona Party Chair, Raquel Tehran, said, While we take no pleasure in this announcement, the ADP Executive Board has decided to formally censure Senator Kyrsten Sinema as a result of her failure to do whatever it takes to ensure the health of our democracy. The attempt to pass voting rights legislation died in the Senate recently, a huge blow to President Joe Biden and his party, in a year which finishes with midterm elections in which Republicans are expected to prosper. Kyrsten Sinema supported two bills, but they were blocked by Republicans after hours of emotional and at times deeply personal debate over voting rights, racism, and the fragility of American democracy. U.S. Republicans were able to block the bills because Sinema and another moderate Democrat, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, opposed the move to carve voting rights issues out of the filibuster. The Senate rule, which most legislation requires 60 votes to progress. Saying she opposed reform because the filibuster protected the rights of the minority, Kyrsten Sinema said in a floor speech, "She was committed to doing my part to avoid toxic political rhetoric, to build bridges, to forge common ground, and to achieve lasting results for Arizona and this country." Critics point out that not only do Republicans in the 50-50 Senate represent millions of fewer Americans than Democrats, but the GOP itself was recently happy to change filibuster rules to require only a simple majority to confirm Supreme Court justices. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was therefore able to nominate three hardline conservatives to a Supreme Court which had already gutted federal voting rights protections. Since that Supreme Court decision in 2013, and at a growing pace since Trump refused to concede defeat in 2020, Republican state governments have passed laws which critics say are meant to make it harder for communities which lean Democratic, particularly black voters, to cast their ballots. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, stoked uproar recently when, after the failure of the Democratic voting rights push, he said, "The concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans." Diana DeGette, a Democratic representative from Colorado, said, "African American voters are Americans, and to suggest otherwise is about as racist as it gets." Critics say other Republican measures will make it easier for the GOP to overturn election results. In her statement on Saturday, 22nd of January, Raquel Taran said, "The Arizona Democratic Party is a diverse coalition with plenty of room for policy disagreements." She said, "However, on the matter of the filibuster and the urgency to protect voting rights, we have been crystal clear in the choice between an archaic legislative norm and protecting Arizonans' rights to vote. We chose the latter, and we always will." Raquel Taran praised Kyrsten Sinema's role in passing COVID relief and a bipartisan infrastructure bill, key parts of Joe Biden's agenda. But she also highlighted Republican attempts to audit and overturn Donald Trump's defeat in Arizona and election laws being passed nationwide. She said, "The ramifications of failing to pass federal legislation that protects the right to vote are too large and far-reaching." A spokeswoman for Senator Kyrsten Sinema said, "During three terms in the U.S. House and now in the Senate, Kyrsten has always promised Arizonans she would be an independent voice for the state, not for either political party. She's delivered for Arizonans and has always been honest about where she stands. Nonetheless, the senator has suffered significant blowback." Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator and leading progressive, said recently he could back primary challengers to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in 2024. Sinema also saw Emily's List, a so-called right group, withhold its endorsement. In a statement, Emily's List president, LaFonza Butler, claimed, "We believe the decision by Senator Kyrsten Sinema is not only a blow to voting rights and our electoral system, but also to the work of all partners who supported her victory and her constituents who tried to communicate the importance of this bill." According to OpenSecrets.org website, a Democratic fundraising juggernaut, Emily's List was Kyrsten Sinema's top political donor in her 2018 Senate race. Another so-called right group, Naral Pro-Choice America, said it would only endorse senators who support changing the Senate rules to pass the critical legislation that will protect voting rights. Arizona's other Democratic Senator, Mark Kelly, was on Saturday, 22nd of January, fundraising off his decision to support filibuster reform on voting rights matters, which he said was a tough one, but the right one for Arizona and our country. "The effects of censure by a state party are debatable. In Arizona, the Republican John McCain was censured in 2014 for what his state party deemed too liberal a voting record. The senator and 2008 presidential nominee, John McCain, took it in his stride as part of his public image as a political maverick. Kyrsten Sinema won the Arizona Senate seat vacated by Jeff Flake, an anti-Trump conservative, and also presents herself as unbound by traditional political codes. Last year, Chuck Cochran, a former Republican operative in the state, told The Guardian, "Kyrsten Sinema was a pragmatist who understands that if she is to succeed in Arizona, she must succeed in this lane." However, Sandra Cole, a Democrat who once campaigned for Kyrsten Sinema, said, "She's not John McCain. She's not a maverick. I didn't agree with him on many things, but at least we knew where he stood."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, an interesting question, especially for those who are interested in religion and religious concepts, and that is the concept of compulsion in religion. There is still a misunderstanding among the believing people, even in the world of Islam. Nowadays, I could see it in the so-called broad-minded intellectual Sayyid Mohsen referring to one part of the verse of the Quran, 256, you know, like Prophet Deen. There is no compulsion in religion, and they try to give their own interpretation. So, when there is no compulsion in religion, why am I being converted to Islam, or why am I being at all called a Muslim? Oh, of course, the deen has to be defined over here. What is it? What's your answer to that?
Well, La ikraha fi deen is before you become a Muslim.
Okay.
This verse, this part of a verse, La ikraha fi deen, is before you become a Muslim, there is no compulsion in the religion. Obviously, you judge the religions, okay, and then you accept. Once you have accepted Islam, then obviously this verse does not have any application on the Muslims.
The problem is with this accepting mechanism. When you are born into a Muslim family, what is the accepting mechanism over here?
All right, there you need to, obviously there is no, you have to study.
You know, generation after generation.
The mechanism okay, for the Muslims, I said this in the beginning of the discussion as well, that Allah talks about tafakkarun, ta'aqilun. He talks about getting knowledge. And he, obviously, Islam is against following anything blindly.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. But La Ikraha Fi Deen, number one, is there are different aspects of this. Number one is for those who are non-Muslims, who are looking for the right path, and they are searching for it. And then once they have decided that, okay, Islam is the right path, and they accepted Islam,
okay.
Now they're entered into the Islam.
Okay.
Now for them, before that, yes, there wasn't any ikrah.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any compulsion.
Yes.
Like, there wasn't any sword or anything, like, to accept Islam. This is the wrong way of,
mm-hmm.
You know,
converting the people,
converting people,
yes,
into Islam.
People,
this is the wrong way. So this is not the way, number one. Number two, once you have entered the Islam, obviously there are specific rules.
Okay.
Let me just give an example. Like, for example, if you want to travel, you decide to travel to any country in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the, for example, the UAE,
yes.
For example,
yes.
Arab Emirates, if you go like UAE,
yes.
There they have their own rules.
Okay.
You cannot just go to the...
Yes.
You cannot go. You cannot go to the seaside the way,
yes,
you go in Brighton, for example, in,
yes,
in UK,
okay,
or in any other country. There is a specific rule.
Okay.
So before you're deciding to enter to a country for spending your summer holidays or vacations, you have a multiple choice.
Of course, we are not.
There is no compulsion on you.
To go where they have, yeah, the summer vacation in UAE.
There's no,
but once
segregation between male or female. Yeah. Why not? But anyway,
has been recently attacked by the Yemen Houthis. You know why not?
So basically, even if someone enters the Pakistan or maybe like Iran or some Islamic countries,
yes,
there are some compulsions. They have,
okay,
to obviously be bound
to
with those,
by the rules,
yes,
and
by
the laws
by
over
the
there.
Rules.
Okay.
Even someone who's traveling to US, for example, or,
okay,
to UK,
yes,
there are specific rules. There are traffic rules. There are different rules,
okay,
for the immigrants.
So where do you want to get to, brother?
So the problem is, like, when we talk about like Ikraha Fi Deen, there's a misconception about it,
mm-hmm,
that they put this in every aspect of their life. That is wrong.
Okay.
There is a limitation of this verse. That's the first thing. The second thing is for the Muslims, as you said, like for them who are born in a Muslim family, what should they do? Number one, they should learn about their own language, their own
religion.
Okay. That is necessary. And, you know, the problem is because the parents are illiterate,
mm-hmm,
in the religious sense. Because they are illiterate, that's why their generations are illiterate. We can see, like, in the Islam, they say, like, when the boy becomes 15 years old, he's baligh.
Mm-hmm.
Or the girl in the 9 years old, she's baligh. And in the book of rules, we read that the girl or boy who becomes baligh, they should choose a mujtahid, a person, a jurist, and they should select it and do taqlid. Now, does that boy or girl have this capability,
mm-hmm,
or capacity of knowing about a jurist,
okay,
or making a kind of judgment out of it?
Yes.
Obviously, it depends on their training, how they were grown. It all depends on them. Our issue is because the parents themselves do not have enough knowledge of religion, that's why this is not being conveyed to the next generations.
Okay.
And that's the main issue. There is no issue in being born in the religious family or the Islamic family and following Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because of our parents.
By force, okay. Okay, like Rafa Deen.
I kind of disagree with...
Is this Deen Islam?
Yes.
Is it?
Religion.
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 No, okay, it's not Islam.
You brought
it
forward,
Islam.
No problem. It's,
okay,
it's about Islam precisely. This,
okay,
verse is talking about Islam, it's talking,
yes,
about Quraysh, it's talking about the Kuffar during that time,
mm-hmm,
right? And of course, the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
okay,
is Islam. What is the meaning of Islam? Submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm.
It's the religion of Moses, of Abraham. It's a submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And one of the main things to submit to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is to submit to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, to submit to his successor Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and who comes after him, salawatullah wa salamu alayhi. The thing is, I kind of disagree. Why did you separate between it's compulsory for Muslims and not compulsory for non-Muslims? The verse is talking only about kafir. It's talking towards the kuffar. It's talking towards the kuffar. It's saying la ikraha fi din. It doesn't have to do anything with the Muslims here. I think that we should talk more about what is the meaning of compulsory that you guys are trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
What is the meaning of force?
Yes.
Do you mean al-hurriya or freedom in the sense that there is no, for example, effects if I disagree with Islam? Then that really goes back to how about inheritance,
mm-hmm,
when a kafir cannot inherit from a Muslim?
Yes.
How about the laws that say about al-jihad al-ibtida'i and the difference between,
yes,
the scholars available and the sayings available? So what I want to say here is that there are laws available out there that contradict with the fact that there is no compulsory, that the meaning of compulsory that
yes,
I want to put forward, right?
Okay.
So I think here, and especially with the sayings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam that explain it, especially with the Mufassireen state themselves, the meaning of this verse is not saying that you don't force people. Mm-hmm. It says there is no force. There's a big difference between the two.
Yes.
When you order someone to not force someone,
yes,
it's obliging you to not fight him. It's obliging you to not it's obliging you to allow him, mm-hmm, to spread his beliefs and whatnot, okay, and whatnot, to inherit, to do this and that, everything that has to do with his freedom of religion. Mm-hmm. No, it's not like that. It's telling you that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created human beings with the free will to choose the religion.
Okay.
This and various verses state this, that if you guys want to really, إِنَّ هَدَيْنَهُ النَّجَدَيْ يَا أَخِي, my brother, you want to follow this, this is the religion, this is the right rule, this is the right way. Okay. You want to follow it or not, that's up to you. But whatever happens at the aftermath, it's on you. It's your fault. In this sense, yes. Therefore, if the...
And you mean that out of your free will and determination, they will automatically choose the religion of Allah because of the fitrah?
Yes, that's available. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed the...
We'll get to that later.
Get to that later.
Okay.
But the thing what I want to say here is that it's telling human beings, it's sensing them, it's telling the Prophet that if you rip your clothes, try to bring mountains, you break mountains, you do whatever you can.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it's their choice.
Okay.
They're gonna choose. It's up to them. We haven't created you in a manner where you're a Muslim or you're a kafir.
Okay.
We have created you in a manner that you choose.
Mm-hmm.
You pick Islam, you pick the religion that you want to follow,
yes,
or you don't pick. That's up to you. But at the end of the day, there comes situations where Islam is a government.
I couldn't understand where you're different, like, from what I explained. We explained the same thing.
Yeah.
That before you become a Muslim, obviously you have a choice. There is no pressure.
Even
like
after Islam. Sorry, I'm talking about free will here.
What about
the verse is talking about free will? It's not talking about how we deal with non-Muslims, how we preach Islam. That's
brother,
what I want to
brother
say.
Habib.
What about the concept
that was
revelation
the one example
and place of revelation of these words? I mean, that some of the children of Ansar, you know, the fathers used to force them into convert into the religion of Islam because they were interested in Christianity, and then come to Prophet Muhammad, and Prophet Muhammad answered, says that there is no compulsion in religion. Where is that saying?
Isn't it saying?
No, I'm asking you.
Well,
you're the one that brought it up. Where's
the reference?
Where's the reference?
Okay, the reference.
That's the thing.
Yeah, I will bring the reference, man. No,
while you're looking for the reference, I want to go back to say it.
I was just giving an example.
Like before Islam, huh?
Yeah.
I understand.
It was just
an
example. Yes, before Islam, there is obviously you have a free will to choose whatever. But once you have chose one thing, obviously you have to follow some rules.
You can't
there
say that. What you're trying to say is that you can't say that you're a Muslim, mm-hmm, and therefore
still
not follow Islam.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm cool with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
The reference is Al-Mizan, volume number 2, page 348.
That's not a reference. I'm sorry to tell you that.
In Majma' al-Bayan Tabrisi also.
Not a reference. I'm sorry to tell you that as well.
What other reference?
Just read the whole narration. What do you have here?
The narration.
Maybe you translated it wrongly.
No.
It's not translated wrong. I've seen it.
No. It is saying that some people from Ansar, the children, especially the sons, you know, were trying to convert into the religion of Islam because they were under the influence of two preachers of Christianity on that time through a storytelling of this and that. So, and the fathers were interested into converting them into the Islam. So they come to Prophet Muhammad and they ask him, what must we do? And says there is no compulsion of religion. Mm. And this is the Sha'an al-Nuzul of that ayah. Okay,
yeah.
whatever possible, I do want to say first, if this is the case, too, first of all, the audience of this verse might be the youth or the young and this and that. And the second is that when we say there is no compulsion religion, it means that let them be free, automatically they will see the beauty of Islam and they convert into the religion of Islam. This is the case that happened at the time of Prophet Muhammad to most of his companions, too.
I think there is one thing which is like missed over here. When we are talking about the Ansar becoming Muslim, and obviously, you know, at that time there was a father and son, the whole family.
Yes, yes.
Maybe the father only converted into Islam.
Okay.
Exactly. And the children might be under the influence of maybe Christians or the Jews.
Yes.
Or
their families, their uncles.
It's not the child who is born within the Islamic family. There's a difference.
So, no.
We need to differentiate between these two things. One is a child is born into the Muslim family.
Okay.
Once there is the family from whom the father only have chosen, like, the
Islam.
And the rest haven't done it.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we have, like, the way you were portraying the things, like you were trying to explain the things, the Prophet has said, like, everyone has been born on the fitrah.
Okay.
And there is no Masihi, Yahudi, or La Nasraniyan, or La Yahudiyan. Mm-hmm. There are no Christian or Jews. But on the other hand, obviously, we say that if a child has been born within the Islamic family, obviously, he's a Muslim.
Okay.
Now he has to research about the religion first, and then. And we cannot just put a ruling that he has become, for example, a Christian, or he has become an atheist, or maybe he has a question. And that's another issue within our Muslim families.
Right.
That, for example, when kids have such a question, mm-hmm. we need to give their answers. It is not necessary that they have become atheist. They might have some questions from their schools, but they have discussions with the teachers or the other other friends they have. So that's that. Always, like, that's that also goes back to the problem that we have in parents, that they are not literate in the religious sense.
Yes.
Because they haven't studied the religion themselves, that's why they're unable to answer. And then we have these issues in the West that we have today. Brother Habib, if you have something to...
Okay, we are done with the time. one more final moment.
He has something to say.
1 minute. I wanted just to summarize what he's saying. He was saying that in this saying, first of all, let's prove its reference, right?
Yes. Okay.
If it's available, okay, come over here. Who says that this father has had enough? He's coming to, talk to the Prophet to take his advice. What do I do? I did this. I told him this about Islam. I told him this. At the end of the day, he doesn't want to believe in Islam. What should I do?
Okay.
So the Prophet says, "There's like Rahaf al-Din. There's no compulsion in religion. You can't force someone to believe in something."
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between the way you stated it and the way that I stated it.
Sorry, but the case is that at least there must be some reference to some facts during the history for the revelation of such verses of the Quran, isn't it?
If you follow my program, Quran Quest, you would see a lot of things that I state over there. One of the things that I state is that revelations of the verses have been limited to some extent. Some of them, some of the sources are weak. Some of the sources, they contrast with the verse and the meaning of the verses that the Mufassirin state. And that is why it's kind of limited. So we reached to a point that it's not necessary to know every reason of revelation, although it is helpful, but it's at the end of the day, it's not a necessary.
So I mean, finally, this ayah, I mean, this part of the ayah, La Ikraha Fid Din, must open the gates for the people in order to do more research about the religion of Islam out of the free will and determination.
Yes, they have free will.
They
have free will. You chose this path.
Okay.
And therefore, the aftermath of it, it's your fault.
See, there are so many questions that if the new ideas are coming up in the Muslim world by some, it is opposed by some other Muslims in a very, barbaric, violent forms, okay? That if you, for example, ask new questions or bring new doubts, you're going to be killed or something like that, okay? I don't want the answer to that.
I believe this.
Okay.
I've never seen the Prophet, nor the Imam, alayhi wasalam, in a saying,
yes,
rebuke or criticize someone for asking something.
Mm-hmm.
For asking something, and look, what I mean, when I say asking, they truly want to know what's right and what's wrong.
Okay.
I'm not saying what they're asking and they're trying to make fun of the Imam or trying to make fun of the religion of Islam, like how some atheists used to do. Philosopher atheists used to sit down in Mecca. Yes. So I have never seen the Prophet, nor the Imam alayhum as-salam, nor the companions of the Imam alayhum as-salam do such a thing, nor have I seen scholars from the Imamiyyah, right? So at the end of the day, you should tell that to some other sects of Islam. Not us.
Not us. Okay.
Us means Shia.
Shia. Yeah.
Okay, thank you much, brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen, for presence in the program. Viewpoints talking about compulsion in the religion of Islam. It's very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website, apostolate.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know that I need amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Measured by the value of the wages that workers take home, which this board regards as the most important metric for assessing the health of America's economy, President Biden's first year in office was not a very good year. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. It has been written by the paper's editorial board. The piece is titled, President Biden's Economy is Failing the Big Mac Test. Measured by the value of the wages that workers take home, which this board regards as the most important metric for assessing the health of America's economy, President Biden's first year in office was not a very good year. The dollar figures on workers' paychecks rose handsomely over the past 12 months, but for most workers that wasn't enough to keep pace with the highest inflation in several decades, which eroded the value of each of those dollars. The purchasing power of the average worker's weekly pay declined by 2.3% from December of 2020 to December of 2021. Data for the final 20 days of Joe Biden's first year in office is not available as yet, but is unlikely to improve that picture. Joe Biden inherited an economic crisis precipitated by the coronavirus pandemic, and his administration deserves credit for orchestrating a fiscal response on a scale commensurate with the nation's need. The outstanding achievement of Mr. Biden's first year in office was the passage of an economic aid package in March that shielded Americans from the economic effects of the pandemic and helped to deliver a faster recovery than in other developed nations. In simple terms, things could have been a lot worse. The Biden administration also has taken some significant steps to improve the nation's longer-term economic prospects, notably by pushing an infrastructure bill through Congress and by launching a revival of antitrust enforcement. In a late December tweet, Joe Biden quoted with evident approval an assessment that he had compiled the strongest first-year economic track record of any president in the last 50 years. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on Friday, 21st of January, "By most traditional metrics, the pace of our current recovery has exceeded even the most optimistic expectations." But most Americans don't share the administration's sunny view of its economic record, and it is little mystery why. The average worker's paycheck doesn't buy as many hamburgers as it did last year. Using hamburgers to measure inflation is a twist on The Economist magazine's Big Mac Index, which tracks the price of the classic hamburger in different currencies. The government's Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7% in 2021, the biggest jump since 1982. Joe Biden's approval rating remains low, and poll after poll finds that Americans are not pleased with his handling of the economy. Nearly two-thirds of the American public says the administration is insufficiently focused on inflation, according to a recent CBS News opinion poll. There are similar numbers in other recent polls. The nation's mood has soured, even as the economy has added more than 6 million jobs over the last year. For the core of the labor force, workers aged 25 to 54, employment recovered more quickly than in the prior three recessions, dating back to the 1990s. That's a big deal. Even when paychecks are losing value, it's better to get one. Low-wage workers have seen particularly strong wage growth. For workers in the bottom third of the wage distribution, Arin Rajit Dhoob, an economist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, estimates that average wage gains have exceeded inflation. If inflation remains strong, however, the number of workers in that fortunate category is likely to shrink. And even for those workers, the pace of wage growth adjusted for inflation is weaker than it was in the 2 years before the pandemic. Economic output, or gross domestic product, GDP, has climbed above its pre-crisis level. Investors have reason to be happy too. The Standard & Poor's 500, a broad measure of the stock market, rose by 19.3% during Joe Biden's first year as president. The market's large losses this past week wiped out only a small portion of those gains. The White House finds itself in the position of a physician who has administered a successful course of treatment, but who has neglected to prepare the patient for the side effects or to give the timeline for a full recovery. A lot of pain was averted, but it's hard to feel gratitude for things that didn't happen. The economic outlook is strong, but it's hard to feel gratitude for things that haven't happened yet. Right now, the pain of inflation is front and center for most Americans. No one is surprised when recessions deliver unpredictable disruptions. We're now being reminded that recoveries are messy. People are trying to buy more cars than are readily available. Diners are more eager than waiters to return to restaurants. The nation's cargo ports have been overwhelmed by a surge of imports. Joe Biden. Biden, however, has contributed to his own political woes. Through much of the fall, the president and other administration officials seem to be downplaying the dangers of inflation. Mr. Biden also continues to present the administration's longer-term economic initiatives, like antitrust enforcement and a push for childcare subsidies, as measures that would help to combat inflation. The effect of such policies would not be felt for some time, and Mr. Biden's insistence on this implausible narrative may be contributing to a sense that he's not taking inflation seriously. The administration has not taken action in some areas that could help to restrain inflation or mitigate its effects. The tariffs that Donald Trump imposed on Chinese imports remain in place. Legal immigration has continued to decline, worsening labor shortages. A one-year expansion of the child tax credit helped to reduce the share of American children living in poverty to the lowest level since the government began to keep records in the 1960s. But Democrats, unable to agree on the terms of a permanent expansion, have allowed the expanded benefits to expire, depriving millions of working families of much-needed help. Some of the president's critics assert that the United States missed the chance for a Goldilocks recovery, neither too cold nor too hot. They argue that a smaller dose of economic aid would have delivered growth without higher inflation. But European nations with generally administered proportionally smaller doses of aid are now experiencing both less inflation and slower recoveries. Critics also ought to keep in mind that not-so-distant past, in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, the United States similarly delivered an inadequate dose of aid. Inflation remained quiescent, but that was little comfort to the millions who waited years to find work. The challenge now is to bring inflation back under control without undermining the economic recovery. The work will mostly be done by the U.S. Federal Reserve, not by Joe Biden or his administration. The role of presidents in shaping the nation's economic fortunes is generally overstated. But if the government can complete the work it has begun, the administration may yet deserve the victory lap that it is taking for successful stewardship of the nation's economy. The discomforting truth is that the United States last year faced a choice between a protracted period of economic pain and an economic recovery whose benefits are temporarily attenuated by high inflation. Joe Biden made the right choice, but it came at a real price, economically for the nation and politically for him.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.